Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Richard Hanley. Dr. Hanley is a philosopher, formerly of Monash University in Australia, now a professor of philosophy at the University of Delaware. He's the author of The Metaphysics of Star Trek. Welcome, Dr. Hanley.
Thank you very much.
Now, as we spoke before we started the interview, I'm a great fan of your work and of the general theme of the use of Star Trek to illustrate issues. We've got hundreds and hundreds of Star Trek episodes, many of which address philosophical themes.
They sure do.
And your book, I'm sure, has been used in many, many classrooms and as a text.
Yeah, several philosophers have used it relatively regularly in classes. Most commonly at reasonably intro-level courses to get people into the issues going.
Star Trek was originally outlined in the 1960s by the writer Gene Roddenberry.
Right.
And one of the basic things that people have observed about Roddenberry, although there are some revisionist critics who take issue with it, is the idea that his universe was an optimistic one. That
right.
He projected that all intelligent life would basically be able to get along. We might have some bumps and frictions along the road, but eventually the Klingons would join the Federation kind of thing.
Right.
Do you think that that reflects a basic opinion about intelligence, the kind of compatibility of all intelligence?
I guess it's my view too at bottom, and that's one reason that Star Trek always attracted me even as a kid, is that it seems to me that after a certain level, when people have enough of the edges knocked off of them by experience, that and you begin to look at things a bit more objectively, it's hard not to see other sides of things, and there's a lot less reason for people to fight with each other, I think, once they realize that few things are as black as white, as we start out thinking.
It's in striking contrast to the kind of Hobbesian universe that a lot of other science fiction portrays, kind of unrelenting conflict between
right.
every other species who would want our planet and our
right.
water and everything.
Yep.
And the other thing that seems right off the bat striking to me about Star Trek, and just let me preface this with a brief shameless self-promotion. I did some research back in the early 90s on the attitudes of environmental writers and bioethicists
uh-huh.
towards a variety of different bioethical topics. And one of the things I discovered was that the more that they watched Star Trek, the more likely they were to preference chimpanzees and dolphins over mice and fish and lower species.
Oh, that's fascinating.
In terms of their rights. There were
yep.
there were people who were opposed to using animals in any kind of experimentation and those who were in favor of using it for all animals.
Right.
But the people who had a Star Trekian view tended to think the more intelligent something had, the more you should treat it differently.
Right, right.
And this seems to be a kind of basic the non-speciest or not a critique of anthropocentrism seems to be a kind of basic metaphysical or moral constituent of the Star Trek universe.
Absolutely, it's interesting that you say that. One of the things that got me most interested right when I first started using Star Trek in the classroom, a few years before I wrote the book, was that was a little phenomenon that surprised me. It's less to do with other species, but it has to do with artificial intelligence in particular. When I would teach philosophy of mind in a relatively introductory context, and in general, people come into a class like that. At least American students do. At least 2-1 against the idea that artificial intelligence is possible. And, in fact, usually 3-1. And I used to do a few exit polls, so I'd give them arguments for functionalism and various other things and then poll them on the way out. And basically, they didn't change their mind at all about anything. So they were still just as opposed to the possibility of artificial intelligence after the class as before. And then when I started showing Star Trek and just depicting, you know, Star Trek's depiction of the android Data in particular, and I'd given the same material, and then in exit polls, most of them had changed their mind.
That anecdote's as disturbing as it is optimistic.
I know. It's kind of... You think, well, you know, on the one hand, it might be that they're changing their minds for really bad reasons, or it could just be that having the visual fiction there makes certain possibilities vivid to them in a way that, you know, they weren't taking them seriously before. And so my optimistic take is the second one, that it just sort of opened them up a bit more to argument. But
Carl Sagan, before he died, was greatly exercised about the X-Files, and of course a lot of secular humanists are exercised about the popularity of fantasy TV, medium TV and things like that.
Oh yeah.
You know, that it kind of validates or creates the plausible possibility for people of the existence of these things.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the role of science fiction to create the plausibility of actual scientific possibilities out there.
Yes, indeed, that is a possibility. I mean, I guess I'd be surprised if those kinds of shows, you know, things like The Pet Psychic and, you know, Crossing Over and the like, I'd be surprised if they aren't just pandering to attitudes that people already have for the most part. But
Let me return for a second to this this issue about the distinction between the rights of humans and the rights of intelligent people.
Uh-huh.
Recently, Wesley J. Smith, who's a critic of American bioethics, he's begun to write articles, and he's coming out with a book shortly, which attacks the personhood theory in bioethics, connects it to transhumanism, which is the theory that human beings should evolve beyond humanness.
Right.
And connects that in turn to the theories of Peter Singer for animal rights, a kind of argument for animal rights on the basis of the potential personhood of orangutans and gorillas and so forth. It seems like Star Trek, this basic distinction, the idea that you can have a political community of intelligent persons, irregardless of species, does in fact make that kind of argument.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, you know, I'm not ashamed to admit that I have a very Singer-style intuitions on these matters, and Singer thinks that the possession of a self-concept is necessary and sufficient for personhood. I guess I'm a little more Kantian than that, and that I think moral agency is probably a necessary condition as well. And so mere self-concept isn't quite enough. But I think, attitudes towards what kind of thing we are in virtue of which we enjoy the special moral status that we do divide into two basic kinds. And there's a kind that's associated with a range of liberal attitudes in ethics generally, and that's a psychological approach to personhood. And so I'm definitely in that psychological camp along with Singer and a bunch of others. And it seems to me that that's clearly where Star Trek is situated as well. The writers have consistently run that kind of line over the years.
And yet the part that always bothered me, well, the number of things that bother me about the universe, but one thing that bothered me about it was very hostile to the idea that human beings could or should transcend the humanness.
Right.
We met other species which were transcending and becoming, you know, becoming Q-like and, you know, having unlimited powers. But human beings fought these eugenic wars, and Khan is a big bad, and it's impossible to genetically engineer your kids to be super intelligent. So, you know, it seems like a basic contradiction there.
Yeah, I guess... I mean, there certainly is a tension there, I think, and it's probably due to a number of different things. I mean, the Star Trek writers, no matter how visionary Roddenberry might have been, are still, you know, pretty much 20th century people steeped in 20th century ethical traditions. And a lot of those have been handed down, rightly or wrongly, through Western religion. And so I'm sure a part of what's going on here is that there's you know, mankind is already in an important sense perfection, and you know, that it's actually sacrilegious to try to change what already is the pinnacle of development. But you know, myself, I don't hold that kind of view, and I doubt that you do either.
I'm speaking. Let me just reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Hanley. He's a philosophy professor at the University of Delaware and the author of The Metaphysics of Star Trek. This is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J. Speaking of that idea that human beings are the pinnacle of development, although we're tolerant and we're the first of among equals, it seems, in the Federation.
Right.
The subtitle of the paperback version of your book is Data a Person? Right.
Right. Is Data human?
Is Data?
I had nothing to do with that title. But,
right. A complicated title, but
right.
But there is this trial, this classic episode where Picard defends Data from being taken apart by a scientist, and has to defend the personhood, basically, not the humanness, but the personhood of Data.
Indeed.
And that is of course stands by itself as a wonderful ethics lesson. At the same time, Data is this classic Pinocchio figure who wants to be human, and even though he supposedly doesn't have any emotion, somehow he has the emotion of wanting to be human.
Right. Yes. Yes. Indeed. One of the things that I argue is that Data is importantly self-deceived. That. He's actually bought into this lie that humans have delivered to him, and that he's fundamentally different in the sense of not having emotional capacities at all. Whereas anybody taking a reasonable, intentional stance towards Data's behavior would describe him as having quite an impressive range of emotions. So.
Right. At worst, he's just stunted in his emotional responses.
Yes. Yes. And indeed, you know, part of my explanation for that is that what stunted him is nobody giving him a shot, telling him at every turn that he didn't understand or didn't have the capacity. So.
Now, so let's return to the Data's trial for a second. There's this classic argument in artificial intelligence, the Turing test, that if you could talk with an artificial intelligence and you couldn't tell it from a person, then it would be considered a person. On what grounds did Star Trek defend Data's personhood, keep him from being taken apart?
Well, it was on the standard Turing test-style behavioral grounds, yeah. That, I mean, ultimately the decision that the JAG officer made was on a benefit of the doubt principle. You know, if you listen to what she says right at the end of the trial, it's, well, you know, I'm not sure whether he's a person or not, and you know, since I'm not sure, I'd better give him the benefit of the doubt, which is probably a reasonable principle to apply if there really is doubt. But I would have given a more positive decision in his favor.
What are some of the other circumstances in which we met in Star Trek species that created some kind of doubt about whether they are intelligent or not, and whether they fit within the moral universe of persons?
Yeah, well, there have been a bunch of episodes. Probably the most memorable of the original series ones concerned the Horta, the sort of rock-like creature that lives in mineshaft and is killing miners, and miners are killing it. And
silicon-based.
Yes, it's silicon-based. And of course, the... Kirk discovers that it actually behaves quite intelligently when threatened with a weapon, and then manages somehow to communicate. Of course, Spock intervenes with a mind meld to the rock, but that was one of the first ones to really develop this theme, and you get that continued in the later series, especially in The Next Generation. One of my favorite episodes there is The Quality of Life, where you have some artificial intelligences, these little things called exocomps that have been developed as a sort of very complicated remote tool. And Data, in a nice twist, becomes the defender of the exocomps and runs a series of trials, which this particular exocomp apparently fails over and over and over and over again. Eventually, Data figures out that it was just too smart and saw through the test, which is nice again, I think.
That our tests may be too limited for some of the things that we meet.
Well, I think that, that's certainly a possibility. It's certainly possible that for all sorts of reasons we might miss intelligence where somebody else might detect it, either because of differences in scale or, differences in appearance that we're not on the lookout for. And I think this shows up a common misunderstanding, too, I think, of behavioral tests like the Turing test. You know, when students first hear about the Turing test, they think that it's being presented as some kind of necessary condition of personhood, that, you're not intelligent until you've passed the Turing test or something. But, these behavioral tests, the idea behind our ordinary explanation of behavior in terms of intelligence would just be that in certain conditions, it's sufficient for the attribution of intelligence that we see certain sorts of complex and interactive behavior.
Now, one of the other places where the technology of Star Trek is very complicatedly utopian and at the same time self-limiting is the transporter. Transporter allows for potentially the backing up of people, so that there would never have to be death necessarily. And their duplication.
Yes. Yeah. This is. It's. This is a tantalizing possibility that Star Trek never comes to grips with, because we have this. We have what, to my mind, is a fiction, namely that the Star Trek transporter is a matter transporter, according to the official story. And, I think that that's not a very good interpretation of everything that happens in the Star Trek canon, and that's probably a better interpretation to think of it as an information transporter, which, as you say, opens up the possibilities not just of copying, but of copying with a view to extending the existence of an individual. And it's interesting that the ordinary person's reaction to that is usually a horrified one, whereas I take a more optimistic line on that hey, this could be interesting, and maybe it's the closest thing to immortality that we have going.
Well, there's an episode where they suddenly realize that they could use the transporter to filter out diseases. There's this aging disease. It's literally an aging disease, as I remember it.
That's right. This is it unnatural causes? I think the
right.
It's the one from the second season of
Next Generation
with
And they just use the copy, or they use the pattern of the person in the buffer and compare it against the one that's diseased and filter out the disease. Yes, of course, it should be. But anyway, the transporter raises all these interesting personal identity questions, because if you are destroying a person at one place, even if you use the same atoms, which, as you say, is a needless idea, but even if you use the same atoms, you still got this problem. You destroy them at one place and put them together someplace else.
Right.
Is it the same person? It's a classic personal identity problem.
It is indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And, there's personal identity issues are hugely controversial in philosophy. The gamut of views runs from people who think that there just aren't any interesting personal identity questions to people who think that there are interesting questions, but they're insoluble. And in between those two views, there's a variety of views about just what constitutes personal identity over time.
Well, the lack of copies of people and the use of the transporter in this kind of unitary fashion kind of implied, for me, a vitalist idea that, that there was only one real person per copy, and you couldn't duplicate it. But that kind of becomes more complicated in the deep space iteration because of the Trill.
It seems like
once you introduce this idea of conjoined personalities and blended personalities, that the personal identity idea opened up into more kind of Parfishian lack of the personal identity is a fiction.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's a. That is one view that you can take. There are actually two Parfittian views. It's Parfit at times in his work seems to be saying that there just aren't any interesting personal identity questions. But a lot of what he says is consistent with a different view, namely that personal identity is just not quite what people have thought it was. It doesn't consist in the persistence of an unchanging ego or something like that. So what Parfit's mainly doing is trying to undermine an egocentric, the old Cartesian ego view of identity. Sometimes called a soul view of identity, that there's some sort of soul or essence that's you and everything else is negotiable. So in abandoning that view, Parfit flirts with the idea that there's just no such thing as the self, but he also flirts equally with the idea that with a more sort of Humean view of identity, that you just somehow or other you just are the bundle of things over time. But and indeed, I tend to favour that second view. I think that we can make sense, and as an exercise in descriptive metaphysics, we can look at all the judgments of identity we actually make, and I think we can come up with a metaphysical view that tracks all those judgments. And so that's what I say answers to personal identity over time.
Now, by the way, we're speaking with Dr. Richard Hanley. He's the author of Metaphysics of Star Trek. He's a professor at the University of Delaware. And I'm Dr. J, and we're listening to Change Surfer Radio. In this Deep Space Nine, we also met Vedic Barile.
He was
a kind of a young, sexy pope, and gets half his head blown
Except
off.
Except he gets to consult with women, which...
legally, yeah, yes. Not even on the sly. It's just right out there in the open. And he's heterosexual, which makes him different from any. But the Vedic Barile, he gets half his head blown off or diseased or something like that.
Right. And yes, he gets a virus, that's right.
A virus. And they decide to keep him alive by putting a prosthetic inside his head.
Yep.
Again, so shameless self-promotion. I've written about the implications of brain reconstruction technology for personal identity.
Right.
And I think that this idea of having a brain that's dependent on a machine is challenging for many people. I mean, we have this cyborg, the fear of cyborgs and the excitement about cyborgs that we see in a lot of popular fiction.
Yeah.
And in the end, Star Trek, or at least Deep Space Nine, is pretty negative towards Vedic Barile surviving with this prosthetic.
Yes, indeed, yeah. There's a lot of... part of the worry that people seem to have is that they think that somehow an artificial brain couldn't sustain thought, and then there's this extra worry that people have that even if it does sustain thought, somehow it can't sustain identity of a human person. And I've used these kind of examples over the years in class a lot, and it's interesting that this is another respect in which people seem to have views that have a tension at the heart of them. Because I find that you can sort of suck people into these kinds of things by running them through a whole lot of scenarios where they have very small gradual replacements over a series of years, and people will say, "Oh yeah, sure, no problem," and then you say, "Well, I tell you what, let's save you a lot of trouble and just get it done all at once. Let's give you a replacement brain," and then suddenly they seem to think that. Of course, there might be a legitimate identity worry there, but they even seem to think that you wouldn't have a thinking thing in that. Even though the end result would be the same, that you've got a completely synthetic brain, in the one case, they seem to regard it as a thinking thing, and in the second case, as being something that couldn't possibly think. So, of course, my own view is that... there's no reason to think silicon couldn't think as well as meat. So I think that's the way that the inconsistency should be resolved. But it's interesting to see these kinds of tensions.
Well, I think Star Trek in general reflected this kind of ambivalence about machine intelligence, because although it defended Data as a humanistic figure, there was very little self-willed machine intelligence in the Star Trek universe. This is 400 years in the future. You would expect there to be you know, a lot more robots and nanites and all those kind of things.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They're just nowhere to be found. And where you do find them, they're ruling over, despotically ruling over primitivized people.
Like the ultimate computer and those sorts of things, yeah. Yes, and indeed, I think there's considerable prejudice, especially in the first series, against machine intelligence. You know, you have there are two Harry Mudd episodes with androids in, and in one of them, you know, they trot out the old thing that machines can't handle contradictions and paradox and all the rest, and they sort of blow up. And,
blow them up with puzzles.
Yes. So it's I do think you know, they were struggling, but I mean, even in their struggles, they're projecting at least, you know, some modicum of a possibility here, which other similar shows weren't even remotely considering. So I guess it's small steps, and I see it as something of a development here, that the main concern in the original series is these computers, these big chunks of hardware. The main concern by the time we've shifted to the next generation has become something very man-like, the android Data. And then, say, in Voyager, they're the central figure who's involved in these kinds of issues is a hologram, the Doctor. So we've sort of slowly but surely moved into the virtual by the time we get to Voyager, and I think that's pretty cool.
That is true. I wish we had more time to talk about the Doctor. He is a very interesting figure.
Yeah.
But we'll have to do that on a different show. Tell me real quick, what's the topic of your next book? You're working on time travel, is that right?
Yeah. I'm working on a book on time travel. I've got a number of papers coming out on this general issue, and I thought it was time to put together a collection of my stuff, arguing in a quite comprehensive way for the possibility of time travel from a philosophical point of view. And I teach a time travel course here at Delaware, so that's going quite nicely. Also say I have another fiction thing going too, which is The Matrix. I have an article in the Warner Brothers collection of Philosophy of Matrix essays, which is on their website, developing a few of the themes that I started with the Star Trek stuff.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it was a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Richard Hanley. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Delaware, the author of The Metaphysics of Star Trek, and watch for his new work on the philosophy of time travel. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.